Yeah, hello and welcome to the Fox Football Podcast on Easter Monday. We hope you are having a very joyful Easter Monday wherever you are. If the holidays have passed, we hope you enjoyed yourselves, didn't eat too much chocolate, didn't drink too much, but had a great time with family and friends. And the same goes to my two guests today on the podcast, Simon Hill, as per usual, and former Newcastle Jets coach and Fox Sports pundit in Scott Miller. Hello, boys.
Good to see you, Garby. Scott's holidays? What holidays?
We don't holidays in football, unless you're not coaching. And potentially at this time of the year, you think it's quite not a good thing to be coaching.
Yeah, well, you've got about six different hats on, haven't you, Scott?
So. Yeah, no, you could, flat caps, bunnets, all sorts. So it's like, you know, driving to the next sort of thing we're working on right now, next hat on.
Good to see you, Scotty.
Welcome
to the podcast for the first time this season. Looking forward to your insights. How's your Easter break been? Have you managed to enjoy yourself at all?
Yeah, I enjoyed not so much chocolate, but my partner's Lebanese, so we had a fantastic meal last night round at the family,
and
which means when you leave, you get Tupperware crates of it. So literally the car was...
Lebanese food is delicious.
It's my favourite. So the car's full, which means the fridge is full when I get home tonight. So I'm looking forward to the second day Lebanese feast. Cannot wait.
Fantastic. Yourself, Simon? Enjoyable amid all the football?
Yes. Busy weekend. Adelaide on Friday and then Central Coast on Saturday. Bit of a day off on Sunday. But no, I enjoyed it. I mean, it was a good weekend of football, which I'm sure we're just about to talk about.
We are. We're getting ready for the finals. And I think these guys were the headline act from the weekend.
Elliott with the corner. On the goal line, and tapped in by Roy Krishna. It is a hat trick for Roy Krishna, and he might just have sealed it for Wellington.
Roy Krishna has been a superstar all season. He's now two goals clear on the goal-scoring charts ahead of Adam Lafondra. He notched his 50th Wellington Phoenix goal on the weekend, and he scored the most goals in a single season for Wellington now. And I dare say he's probably favourite for the Johnny Warren medal. He's certainly going to be right in the mix. That would be a huge honour.
Yeah, I'm very much part of that conversation, and why not? What a turnaround. If you remember, Roy, well, and Wellington as a club last season, but particularly Roy last year, he looked out of sorts. He looked almost disinterested. You know, Darija Kalasic didn't get the best out of him, but Mark Rodon certainly has. And he's been one of the main reasons why Wellington have made the finals and, you know, now... potentially going to get a home final as well. I mean, he's not the only one by any means, but it always helps when you've got a goal scorer, doesn't it? And, you know, he's been terrific this season. We always knew he was a natural goal scorer. And it does make you wonder whether there are more players with ability in Oceania. We don't tend to see a lot of the island players in the A-League, do we? And prior to Roy, I think Benjamin Tatori was one. There's been a couple at Wellington down the years, but not many, is there?
Henry Farodo was another from back in the day.
Yeah, very early days in the A-League, though.
That was NSL as well days. But
And then you're going back to Asala Massey and Commons Manapi in the NSL days. But I can't remember too many others, can you?
No, I can't remember the ones you've just mentioned. having not been here that long. But as for Krishna, what an exciting player.
Yeah.
I mean, you speak of his downturn last year. The response that he gives that team and that club this year is superb. And you know, I'm pretty sure you're going to talk about as a club asset, he's very important to them moving forward.
Yeah, so, I mean, look, they're a reasonable chance to host an elimination final, but if Adelaide takes care of Brisbane on Thursday night, on Anzac Day, then they'll finish fourth and they'll host it. We'll get into the finals permutations a little bit later on, but... Where would he sit for you, Scotty, in terms of Player of the Year and the Johnny Warren medal? I mean, Economides might be around the mark, although he missed a bit of football. Castro, of course. Ninkovic, Lafondra could be right up there. He's been so consistent. Would Krishna top the pile for you?
Yeah, he would, because ultimately you can measure it in certain ways. You can measure it as an influence on your team and therefore the performance or the excitement that he brings to the league. He brings both. And if you look back at the previous winners and their impact they had on their club, He's done that and more, essentially. If you look at how many goals he's scored for this team, the style of play that Mark's playing suits him as well. With the attacking transition that he's got and the speed and mobility he does possess, he's a huge important factor. So it wouldn't surprise me come the end of the year.
Attacking players always get the headlines, don't they?
Yeah,
I'll throw a name. I talked about him last week on the podcast. And he probably won't win it because they don't get the headlines. But I think Neil Kilkenny's been sensational.
He's been brilliant. Yeah. And I'm glad you brought him up because, once again, a system suiting a player.
Yeah.
He's been identified to play in that role and he dictates that team. And it's interesting to see when he's not there and the output technically as well. But I'm glad you brought that up because you probably just swayed me. I'm sort of swinging there because I'm thinking the
sorry, Roy.
Threat. No, but I love central midfielders, those guys that just sit at the base and just dictate the tempo and play, and he certainly does that.
Another one who could figure prominently is Shane Lowry, another one who won't get the headlines. But yeah. I mean, he's not done a thing wrong for the entire season. He's been unbelievable for the team who's dominated the league. How difficult might the situation be for Mark Rudin? A big win for him considering that it's all out there now and he's leaving the Phoenix next year. And let's be honest, he's going to, as it stands, Western United. I mean, he said in his press conference, I haven't signed a contract. That was his get out, let's be honest. I mean, the writing is well and truly on the wall with that one. How big of a boost would that be for a coach considering all the uncertainty around that at the club?
Are you talking from an opponent perspective?
From inside that club, what that win would mean considering... Because he'd probably be thinking in his own mind, potentially, how are they going to adjust and react to this now that they know? Am I going to get a positive reaction or could it all fall in?
Well, irrespective of the manager, the club's got a massive opportunity. You think of the last time they're in the final series. And what they can't do now is let an external excuse, i.e. the manager leaving the football club, to miss this opportunity. This is huge for the club commercially as well.
Yeah.
And from a standpoint of their position in the A-League, it's massive. So I don't think any players will be in that dressing room thinking, well, we've lost our gaffer now, let down tools, because they're their own assets. They're their own CVs essentially now. So I'm foreseeing a big push. The manager can't sit in the room now and say, oh, sorry, guys, we're just going to stop. He can't. So it's game on, and they've got to maximise the opportunity now.
Big decision for Wellington in the off-season. You know, which direction do they go in? I mean, they made a poor decision last year with Dario Kalasic. They rectified that by appointing Rudin this year. And now, of course, they've lost him, which is a big blow for the club. And given that under the current circumstances, they only have, I think it's 1 year left on their licence. I mean, I think that'll change once the independent A-League comes in at some point. Mm. But, you know, what is their identity going forward? You know, are they willing to push the envelope again and you know, get in a coach that they feel is going to take them forward and have them competing for the top six every single year? I mean, I've gone on record. I do a few interviews. I'm sure you do, Garby, as well, and Scott, you know, for radio stations over in New Zealand. And they're always very interested to know the perspective from Australia on their club. And I always say, you know, Wellington should be one of the biggest clubs in the A-League because they've got an entire country to themselves. I know they're based out of Wellington, but the resources they should have behind them from New Zealand football as a whole, and I know that they're fragmented in the same way that we've been for many years, but really that club should be very, very strong. And Oceania should be supporting them as well because they're the only professional club in Oceania. So, you know, they've got big decisions to make as to where they want to go and how ambitious are they going to be going forward.
Melbourne City could have a big decision to make as well. Do you feel as though Warren Joyce needs to win that elimination final to keep his job? Is it as black and white as that?
Not for me. I understand why there's been question marks against Warren Joyce. I've said earlier on in the season, my personal view is I think this is bigger picture stuff with the City Football Group. I'm not saying Joyce hasn't had a part to play in what's gone on this season. I don't think the style of football he plays is particularly exciting. The team looks a little bit disjointed at times. He chops and changes things around. You know, they struggle to get supporters through the gate. But I think it's all part of, again, the identity of what the club is. What does City Football Group want Melbourne City to be? Are they just a production factory of young players for not only the parent clubs, but to make money? I know that's part of the equation, and I have no issue with that personally, so long as they're looking after what's happening at home as well. And I don't think they've done that effectively enough. We all know what the elephant in the room is. They've got money to spend. Mm. They can easily bring in two big marquees.
But will he be the man?
And they don't.
Will he be the man asked to spend that money?
But this is what I'm saying. I'm not sure whether that is their priority, in which case, if it's developing players, then it doesn't matter what the externals are. They think that Warren Joyce is the best guy to develop those young talents. And to be fair, he's got a good record of doing that. Mm. The one other thing I will say about Warren Joyce, he's been under all sorts of scrutiny all season. And a lot of it, I think, is justified. But How much scrutiny has Marcus Babbel been under? Warren Joyce has got his team in the finals. How much scrutiny did John Aloisi have, really, before he resigned in December? I mean, it built a little bit towards a crescendo. But there tends to be, in this country, I think, people find targets. And Joyce is quite an easy target. He's quite a sort of a... Actually, personally, he's a really funny guy. But when you get him in front of a camera, he's quite dour.
Yeah.
You know, the footballer's team plays, as I say, is not particularly exciting. He becomes an easy target. And I'm not saying he's not to blame 100% because I think he is. He's got a lot of questions to answer. But I think there's bigger picture stuff at play with Melbourne City. That's only my view.
No, I agree with the big picture thing. And I was thinking about this flying up here today and I said, right, there are two ways you can look at this. You look at the business and how they want to be perceived. Mm. And ultimately, we sit here thinking Melbourne City should be winning the league because we associate them with their biggest partner. However, then you strip it down and think about, right, this coach's livelihood. And that's what we're talking about right now. Mm. So I go back to the word asset. Your best players you want to retain. You keep them on contract. You give them long-term contracts. A manager going into the last two rounds without a potential contract, that's alarm bells for anybody. And sitting as a coach, if I was not locked down by December, January, going into the last 6 months of my contract, I'd be looking elsewhere. Because the reality is those decisions are made based upon 27 rounds, not two rounds. So that's where they need to be clear. And potentially he's not, but I don't really feel the last two rounds are going to really support his new deal or no new deal. Mm. I really don't, because it's a bigger picture, as Simon alluded to.
Why hasn't Riley McGree played more? I mean,
I wish he had.
Yeah. He scores a double again yesterday. Whenever he plays, he looks exciting. He sat on the bench for the best part of the year. I mean, yes, he had Oli Roux's duty, which interrupted things, but whenever he comes on, he's so enterprising. You just wonder why he wouldn't be a regular.
Those are the questions that are valid and justified against Warren Joyce. Obviously, there's been the Fornaroli stuff as well and other players before him that he appears to have fallen out with. My question really about the way Warren's approached this season, he seems to chop and change every week, and not just personnel, but also his playing system. I mean, he seems to swap from three at the back, four at the back, and Berenguer has played as a central striker. He's played on the left. He's played on the right. Luke Bratton plays on the right. He plays deep in midfield. I don't know. Maybe he just thinks it's great for flexibility. Richie Delatt has played as a central striker. He's played as a right winger. He's played a right back. Delbridge, right back, left back, centre back. It all seems a movable feast. And to me, the players look to be a little bit confused by it. And also, the last thing is, I think they have too many, we said this before, I think they have too many similar sorts of players. They've got a lot of number 10s, of which Riley McGree is one. And they need that little bit of a point of difference, which in fairness, McLaren has given them a bit and Cheyenne Harrison has given them a bit.
I think the beauty of McGree is he can play anywhere. He can play as an 8, he can play wide, he can play as a 10. For me, just get him in the team. He's that good.
But your basic points is right. He should have played.
Adelaide beat the Victory. Can the Reds' style hold up in a final or the finals should they win the elimination game? I mean, they just seem to be in every game but not blowing teams away. Can that maintain itself in a big cutthroat final game?
I think anything's possible. And I like the way Kurt sets his team up tactically every week. He looks at the strengths of the opponent and he deals with that and he sets his team up. You look how organised they were the other night, especially in that first half. They had a definitive plan. Everyone knew the role. And that's what I like about that. And that's what finals football is. You can't necessarily always play your style and system against a top team. But I tell you what, you can actually beat a team via set pieces by defensively being very organised and ensuring your team's ready and prepared tactically.
So it might work
better.
He does. It might work better in finals potentially.
Potentially, yeah, because you look at the result the other evening there. They set up defensively, and that doesn't mean deep. They set up with a mindset to stop key players of Victory. Mm. And with a manager's foresight and his experience from Europe doing that every week, instead of just going, yep, same game plan, it influences every week. And that's what a European manager brings, because you have to do that in the Premier League. You have to set up differently every week. And I do like the fact that Melbourne City has been flexible with playing system. The personnel rotation is a challenge because that really breeds unbalance. But Adelaide, interesting dynamic. They work hard for each other. They're committed. Their manager's on the way out. He'll want to win every game, and his passion's going to be high, and that will inspire his team.
I also like the fact that Kurtz is not only very well prepared tactically, but he's not frightened to tell the public that via the media either. I mean, he said in the Adelaide media on, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday, we know the strengths of Victory. We're going to press them. We're going to try and put them under pressure. And that's exactly what they did. Mm. You know, they tried to stop them playing out from the back, particularly from goal kicks. But whenever they had possession in their own third, they pressed high and with energy as well. And forced an awful lot of turnovers. They really put Victory off their natural game. I don't think Victory had a single shot on target, apart from the goal that was disallowed wrongly, in my opinion. Yep. In the entire 90 minutes. So, you know, job done. And particularly as he's dealing with not the largest amount of resources at Adelaide, I think he's done a reasonably good job. That my question mark against them in the finals, and it's been the same all season. All right, they found a goal scorer on Friday, George Blackwood. Maybe he's the man for them.
We said Stamatopoulos last week.
But they don't score. Yeah. They don't score an awful lot of goals. No. They don't concede many, but they might struggle to score against a Perth or a Sydney when the pressure's really on.
The Victory will have to do it the hard way now. They'll have to win two finals, one of them away from home, to make the grand final. They did do it last year. Are they lulling us into a false sense of security or insecurity again, whatever way you want to look at it?
Oh, listen, would you do it deliberately?
I wouldn't. No, I'm not saying they're doing it deliberately.
But take it easy.
We're falling into that trap again of the Victory can't do it, it's too hard. And then they go and when the finals come around, they just rise because they've got the experience and the quality.
No, what every game will do, Kevin will look at last weekend's game and a lot of managers will be looking at the style of play. So whoever Victory do play next, that was a blueprint how to affect their mid-third. Mm. And essentially, if you're a clever manager, you'll be looking at that and how they didn't deal with the ability to play out through that back third. As you said, the pressure on the ball carrier was immense. The screening of the passing lanes, the second man in terms of supplying that support was huge. So there is a blueprint how to affect Kasuke Honda, how to get Toivonen out of the game. And ultimately, that's going to be very difficult. But I don't think they're nullifying anyone. I think it's based upon their performance. But I just think Adelaide, as you said, nullified Melbourne as opposed to Melbourne not playing well.
You know, I think the biggest problem for Victory is they're going to play City in the first week of
most
the finals.
Probably.
It looks that way. I mean, it's not 100% yet, but it looks as though it's going to be a Melbourne derby. Now, that could be anything.
Yeah.
Because City, as we know, always lift for that derby game. Derbies are not like normal games. Big crowds, you know, all the onus will be on Victory because everybody expects Victory to win. That is a massive banana skin for them, potentially. And it's not that they can't win it. Of course they can. And they would start favourites, rightly so. But City could easily turn them over.
Let's get into the elimination final setup then as it stands right now. It looks like being Victory against City and Adelaide against Wellington. Adelaide beats Brisbane on Thursday night, as we said. They host that elimination final. City, though, can jump into fifth, and this is plausible. The goal difference is six between City and six and Wellington in fifth. City play the Mariners at home. I mean, they could easily turn them 5-0 and Wellington could lose 2-0 to Glory. I'm not saying it'd be easy for them to do it, but like if someone told you those results, you'd go, okay.
You know, 6 weeks ago, you'd say, yeah, Mariners at home, yeah, it could easily be 5 or 6. I think under Alan Stadjic, I know we'll talk about the Mariners in a moment, but I think under Alan Stadjic, I think it's a lot more difficult to get goals. I'm not saying they won't beat them,
yeah,
but to beat them 4 or 5 nil. I mean, they've only lost the one game by more than one goal since Stadjic took over, and they've had two wins as well. So I think that's potentially a tough one. Talking about Victory's potential finals opponents, then, if we're looking further, let's assume they play City, let's assume they get past City, then they're going to have to go to Sydney, play a big blue, and then in all likelihood they're probably going to have to go to Perth and beat Perth. That's even tougher than last year. Wow. when they had to win three games. I think two of them were on the road. Yes, two of those were on the road. Wow.
Well, that would be a deserved title if they're going there. I'm just written that down.
They'll have earned it.
They would have. Big style earned that because not only are they playing big teams that are in good form, the travel associated with that as well. That's cool.
I agree. I don't think City will roll the Mariners like that unless Central Coast go on their Mad Monday a week early. I think it's too difficult of a task, and the Mariners are looking solid under Stadjic, as you say, but it is still open. It's not locked away as we thought, or as you might think when you look at the ladder and you look at the goal difference. It can be overturned considering the fixtures. But a Melbourne derby would be wonderful. That's what we want first week of the finals, just that absolute glamour fixture to kick things off.
Absolutely. And I believe it could potentially be at Amy Park. Is that
yes.
right? I was
reading it'll be Amy morning. Park because Earth. There's three AFL games at Marvel over that weekend, so it literally can't be there. So it'll be at Amy.
I like the sound of that.
Yeah. Perfect.
It'll Close be fantastic. And Adelaide Wellington can still swing either way. Such an open game. So the top two is locked away because Sydney secured second spot.
Top what, three.
Yeah, the top three is locked away. What does that win against an understrength Perth mean, do you think, Scott? Is it something they can hang their hat on and use as a bit of a mental edge, or does the lack of talent in that Perth side, considering they were resting so many players, mean that it's just something you disregard to an extent?
You've got to go out and beat the team that's in front of you, and they did that. And I spoke on Friday about this game in particular, and the key word going into final series is consistency of performance, and that's probably more than one word, but the key word being consistency. And they did that. They executed it. They beat the team in front of them. And I'd much rather be a team with a fully fit squad when it comes to player availability going into the final series with much more confidence and consistency, as opposed to looking back and trying to fix things on the run now. They're looking like they're in good form. They're consistent. They've found a good style of play in a sense that works for the personnel. Mm. And they've challenged Perth. But obviously, they're all weakened squad. But you know what? 3 points. You don't look at the table and go, yeah, but they're all weakened. You take it. Big
Absolutely. Part. And, you know, Sydney have beaten Perth twice now out of three meetings, albeit this last one against, you know, slightly understrength team. But I think probably Steve Corica has not had enough credit for what he's done this season.
We've actually spoken about it a few times on the podcast. But again, now that second spot's been locked away, it does underline what a very...
Had a very good season.
Very good
obviously not
season
as good as the last two, but that was always going to be the case. Yeah. You lose Graham Arnold, you lose Bobeau, you lose Adrian Mirzayevsky, you lose Jordy Bose. He's had to deal with all those things. And he's, you know, some of his replacements, Sim De Jong in particular, Danny De Silva as well, you know, they've suffered massively with injuries. So they've not really been able to play a part. Trent Bahadur, who was flying in pre-season, who he'd probably built a large part of their attacking game around due to his pace and the combination with Lafondre, he's not been available all season. And yet they've still found a way. I don't think they've been as aesthetically pleasing on the eye this year, but they've been effective, and you know they could still win the championship. And you remember last season, they were miles ahead, weren't they? But faltered in the finals. Maybe it's going to be the other way around this time. I reckon that's a big motivation for them.
Mm. Nice moment on Thursday night when Tony Popovich brought his son on, Christian Popovich. Yeah. I mean, it was wonderful to see. How difficult would that be, Scott, to manage your own son? You've been in a position. Can you comprehend what it would be like?
Well, you've got your coach persona and then you've got your father persona. Yeah. And poor boy's seeing both.
And you could see Popper, as intense as he is, he couldn't control his emotion. I was watching him closely. You could tell there was a very different look on his face when his son got the ball.
Yeah, imagine it's like going to school every day. You've been disciplined at school and disciplined at home. Where's your break? But it would be pretty difficult. I mean, we always want to sneak around the back and misbehave a little bit, but so you can't even do that at work. But it must be a proud moment. I'd just imagine the grandparents and the mother sitting in the stands watching her husband and son apply themselves at the top level in Australia. I just think that's a great picture as a family. And
he did all right as well when he came on.
Looked
he was
tidy.
A little bit nervous the first few minutes. Mm. I think he gave the ball away
Wouldn't
a couple
be?
Of times. Oh, yeah, especially in front of your dad.
That's what I mean. Not the game. The game's the easy part.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the dad's expectation.
He settled down and I thought he was okay. It continues a fine tradition, doesn't it, at Perth? Steve McMahon with Steve McMahon Jr. Alistair Edwards with his two
sons.
Well,
the other two didn't work out well, which is why I actually want to have a serious discussion about this, because there aren't too many stories in sport where it's worked out. Mm. For mine, my opinion, unless, and it's fine now.
Brian Clough and Nigel Clough?
Yeah, I was
thinking
Nigel
didn't stay there
away.
For very long. He went to Liverpool. He
John Bond and Kevin Bond?
Moved on.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I know the Bonds, yeah.
Look, it was the perfect game to bring him in. It was virtually a dead rubber, so you give a kid a chance and he's probably deserved it. For mine, unless your son is an absolute gun, or your daughter, an absolute star in the team, it's very hard, because if you bring them in and someone else thinks they were deserving of a spot, it's going to cause friction. Perception will be reality and they'll say you're favouring them. If they're a superstar, there's no arguments because they deserve their spot and you can rely on them. I just think it could be problematic, and I'm sure Tony Popovich has thought about whether he goes to another club in time. He's only 17, and he's probably still living at home, so he has to play for Perth right now while Tony's there.
Yeah.
But in the future, it's a difficult one to manage unless the kid is a superstar, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think it's long-term sustainable because, you know, you use the term identity as a club. Every player needs his own identity. And when you're playing under your father, who's such a poignant role model in Australian soccer right now, that's got to be hard. So his own self-development is going to be limited as well in terms of his own personality and characteristics in the dressing room. So I'd imagine once he gets that start, and if he does continue to develop, I think the advice from home could potentially be, right, go and learn something from someone else. Mature in a different environment where you don't have the protection. But also, the more importantly, not the the comments that you're talking about, the potential talk behind the scene. No one needs that. It's hard enough to be a footballer, let alone be 17 and have your father as the manager. No distractions is the key, and potentially moving forward, it might be a better thing.
It's time for you to leave home, son. Tidy your room before you go.
Oh, wow. Did that ever happen to you? Or were you out first? Boom.
No, I went to university when I was 18 and I never went back. So it's sort of, it was a smooth transition. Yeah.
My dad used to coach me in juniors and it was good for a few years, but he would always, in the yearbook, always criticise me more than any other player as like a way to say I'm not favouring him kind of thing. I was like, give me a spell.
I met your dad in Melbourne a couple of weeks ago.
You did. Doesn't criticise me as much.
Mr. Garb Senior?
Doesn't criticise me as much anymore. His coaching days are long gone, let me tell you. Brisbane were embarrassed on Saturday night. Boy, do they need a coach. Maybe we'll find out some more on that during the week. But it was just humiliating. I mean, they are a team that has completely shut up shop and had done, honestly, a few weeks ago. I mean, Matty Mackay announces his retirement, a legend of the club, a great of Australian football, and they put that out. Wow. Mm.
It's, you know, it beggars belief, really, that John Aloisi resigned in mid-December. And here we are 4 months later, and we still don't know the identity of the next coach. Now, obviously, they're considering people from overseas, which, you know, might make things a little bit tricky. But surely they should have come to a decision before now. I mean, that club is in limbo and has been for months. And it's got to have an impact on the players. I know they've had a lot of injuries as well. I actually feel sorry for Darren Davis because he's been essentially left holding the baby. You know, Drew Sherman, who was briefly his number two, the youth academy director, he left. I think the physios left. Other backroom staff have left. I mean, who's left? I mean, he's essentially doing it on his own. It's not good enough.
That's a problem in itself because
this is a three-time champion club of Australia. Mm. And they've allowed that to, you know, dissipate to an extent where the club is yet again, it's not the first time this has happened, it's an absolute mess.
Their experienced players around someone like Matt Mackay, for me, have been deplorable. Mickelson, Lopez, Christensen have barely fired a shot. Like, where have you seen – Botiak's actually been pretty good as someone in the second half of the year. He's tried to do something. The others, I reckon they threw in the towel a long time ago.
Yeah, well, that's something we can't quantify. But you speak about culture and environment regarding the club. You're alluding to the dynamic of the football club. Mm. And what inspiration does your workplace give you when it's being run in a certain way? Everyone needs inspiration when they come to work, whether it be the environment or the coaching stimulus. But cracks – i.e. physio, i.e. coaching staff leaving and no one coming in to inspire the next phase and fill the gaps is challenging because I know footballers and they'll start to look around and go, why am I here? Am I wasting my time?
I think
time?
You can tell that, Scott, with the body language of some of the players that you've mentioned. Yeah. I wouldn't go so far as to go into the specifics of which individuals, but I think you can tell collectively that the body language of the club is one that's on its knees. And it's not the first time they've been there. Now, last year, you remember, they lost to Ceres Negros in the Champions League, that, you know, the numbers famously peeling off the backs of the shirts. We thought that was their nadir as a club. And everybody thought pre-season that they'd built a good squad that was going to challenge. And yet, here they are again in an absolute shambles of a place. And I just don't know how they allow it to drop this far. Mm. I might be speaking completely out of turn here. You can't run a club from Indonesia. I have to say, I think it's the same with the City Football Group in lots of ways. You can't run a club out of Manchester and Abu Dhabi if it's based in Melbourne, or it becomes very difficult to, unless you've got a really good, strong professional team in place. And it just appears to me from the outside, admittedly, I'm not there every day, that things are allowed to slide and decisions take a long time to be made. 4 months for a coach. 4 months, even though they put together a selection panel, didn't they, which was well over a month ago, nearly 2 months.
Which tells me coaches are being identified and turning the role down. That's right. What that means, because ultimately you go into your job interview, you get two or three red flags and you walk away from it, whether it be budget, whether it be environment, whether it be culture. So the minute you get those answers and you see those red flags, you walk away from the role.
Mm.
And potentially that's what's happening. Yeah, but how do they fix it? How do they change it? Is a coach enough? It can't be.
It would be a start.
Yeah, well, obviously it'll give you a figurehead. Yeah. So everyone in the media will be happy because they've got a figurehead and something to talk about. Yeah. But a coach only fixes and essentially starts the process of the footballing philosophy and the recruitment. Yes, that's fine, but this is a cultural thing for the football club. It cannot get in this position.
Good win for Newcastle. Great to see Joey Champenis back with a double. I mean, it might have been a slightly different season if they had him back a bit earlier. He was really exciting. Roy O'Donovan as well. So some cheer for them. The same for the Mariners. And you speak about coaches and whether it's going to make a big difference to a football club or not, or where other things need to be put in place. But I think Alan Stajic's probably done enough to get the job at Central Coast. That's going to be a huge turnaround for him.
Looks like it, doesn't it? And, you know, I'm delighted for Stajic, obviously, because he's had a very up and down 2019, to say the very least. But he seems to have given them, again, some of that. You say, you know, is a coach enough? Well, I mean, the Mariners were in a massive hole. You know, a club that was clearly almost at war with each other. Certainly a lot of the players appeared to be. Mm. And Stajic appears to have... bizarrely enough, given what went on with the Matildas, appears to have sorted out that culture, at least in the interim. They've got some structure. They're not the best team in the league by a long way, but they look to be playing for their coach. They were full of energy on Saturday night, even though the game didn't really mean anything in terms of league position. Far too good for the Wanderers, who were abject, by the way. They were awful on Saturday night.
Yeah.
And again, speaks volumes as to maybe the things that need to be done in the off-season. But I think Stadge has certainly done enough. Congratulations to him. The Mariners, very good on Saturday. The only cloud, obviously, was the challenge, if you can call it that. It was almost an assault by Kairos. That was an awful tackle.
I don't think I've winced over a tackle more in a long time. The Wout Brahma one was really bad.
Mm.
But that was, you could see it coming. This was like, you could actually see Johan's ankle start awful. To turn.
Mm.
I mean, how it's still connected to his leg, I don't know. I thought this is that's career ender. Delighted that he's okay. But that is as bad as it gets. And we'll get onto VAR a bit later when we go overseas. But, I mean, for me, that's effective use of VAR. Ref didn't see it, has a look, bang, you've got to go off. Same with Stamatolopoulos a few weeks ago, Adelaide against Wellington. Same situation, swift, bang, the right result, and the player is outed rightfully for just a shambolic challenge.
And it's spot on. And what you say is the reason he was sent off from VAR, that actually stops worse challenges happening afterwards. And I see it in the NPL now when referees don't see it. You know what happens to the game? It becomes a farce.
Yeah.
Because it becomes, I'm coming for you.
Yeah, they want retribution.
And I'm coming for you. And then suddenly the rest of the 90 minutes is bad tackle after bad tackle, which means risk for players. So complete agreement.
Most certainly. But a good win for Central Coast. We'll get on to what it means for the Wanderers in a little moment. We've got some good Twitter questions coming through as to, you know, the future with Marcus Babbel, etc. So we'll get to those near the end. I wanted to mark this. 5 years on since the passing of Dylan Tombides. Mm. For mine, it's something in Australian football we should mark every year and ensure we don't forget it. But 5 years is, you know, obviously a significant milestone in what is just, for mine, one of the great tragedies in Australian football history.
Well, you and I, Garby, are fortunate enough to be ambassadors for the Dylan Tombides, 38 Foundation. I agree with you. It's very important this young man's story is not forgotten. A few years ago, I did actually suggest to the FFA that they should instigate a charity shield or a community shield, you know, one-off game to the curtain raiser, as they do in the UK and many other places, or a Super Cup, whatever you want to call it, between the league champions, FFA Cup winners, or, you know, an A-League All-Stars and the grand final winners, whatever you want, and play for the Dylan Tombides Shield.
Mm.
For that trophy, and have all the money that is raised on the day to go to charity, not just testicular cancer, but other charities as well. Make it a day where football, you know, remembers some of our heroes, which we don't do. And Dillon, you know, would have been a, I'm pretty sure he would have been a Socceroo.
Well,
maybe a Premier League.
A lot of people think he'd still be leading the line for West Ham right now. I mean, he was that good. And West Ham have done a remarkable job with him. And that's
why. They haven't forgotten.
And I've spoken to the FFA about this. We need something here in Australia that's, you know, an annual award or an annual tribute for Dillon, because they do it at West Ham. His number's retired. They have Dillon Tombidi's Day on this day every 5 years, or on this weekend, sorry. They did it again on the weekend. And it just gives the family a lift, because I know how much it's affected their life. It has ruined them. And all this stuff really does make them feel proud of what their son did. So, yeah, great to see that he was remembered on the weekend, and we should certainly remember his name and his legacy in Australian football as well. Let's transcend overseas then and have a look at what happened in the Premier League and the Champions League. There's a lot to talk about on that front.
Oh, Walker. Bernardo Silva. Tapped in by Silva. Aguero cross goal! Manchester City have a much craved lead, and it's their boy. Phil Foden flung himself at it and scored a goal of great personal and collective significance.
He is one of their own, and it all stays the same. Liverpool still 2 points ahead. City still a game in hand, but now we're down to the last three and four. I mean, it's crazy. Three games to go for the Reds, four games to go for Man City. The big one coming up this week, away to Manchester United, a shambolic Manchester United after the way they performed against Everton, then away to Burnley, Liverpool home to Huddersfield, a game you would certainly mark down for 3 points on the weekend. It is just...
It's squeaky bum time.
It's more than that, mate.
So who's the happiest man in the room? I'm just trying to look at the two of you.
It's just so intense at the moment.
You're more intense than Simon. I think Simon's Simon's history.
Yeah, well, I played last night. He had an extra day to relax.
But you're right. I mean, we've won it, you know, on three occasions. So I've seen my team lift the Premier League. Obviously, you were probably still in nappies the last day. Probably, were you even born?
99, yeah. Well, I was seven.
You were seven in 1990. Yeah. Right, there we go. So... I think it's going to go down to the wire. I think, you know, City are going to have to win all their games, because I can't see Liverpool slipping up. Obviously, the big test for City is the Manchester Derby, which is Thursday morning Australian time. On the evidence of what we saw from United against Everton on Sunday, City should win quite comfortably. But we know that in Derby games, as we spoke about earlier with the Melbourne version, that doesn't always go according to plan. So there's a big test for City this week. However, you know, if we win all our remaining games, we'll be the champions.
Yeah. Might it prompt a reaction, United's display? I mean, Solskjaer is already under pressure, legitimately. Like, there are people already, they're pointing more at the players.
He can't.
No, not pressure. Under pressure to lose his job.
Right.
But people are already saying, what's going on?
Yeah.
This is not good enough. And of course, he's not going to lose his job for the foreseeable future, but people want a reaction straight away.
Yeah.
And they're pointing the fingers at the players more than the coach.
Well, he pointed them as well.
Yeah, and
he
fair enough.
And said a few key points regarding performance and levels, and basically associated that performance with them, and said, if that happens again, you won't be here. So ultimately, he hasn't taken that job without some form of transfer fund that he'll need to invest, because he wants to play a certain style. And ultimately, sometimes to evolve a team, it needs to change personnel more than anything. And I think that might be the case.
Some stats on how bad it was for United. Their fifth ever Premier League defeat by four goals or more. 11 games in all competitions without a clean sheet. That's their worst run since 1998. Three successive Premier League away defeats for the first time since 95-96.
Wow.
I mean, they're in some ordinary territory right now. So you do wonder if all those stats and all that talk around United for the next few days might prompt some sort of reaction, but then you can only play an emotion.
You hope so, don't
I do hope so, but you can only play an emotion for so long, and eventually the quality takes over, and City have that in abundance over United.
Well, they do at the moment. I mean, Saturday against Tottenham was very tense, very tense. I got home from the Central Coast and watched the last half an hour, and I was pacing around the room. You felt that Tottenham had a goal in them somewhere, that they weren't able to find one, which is obviously good for us. But, you know, City are feeling it as well, you know, particularly on the back of going out of the Champions League against Tottenham. You know, all of a sudden, this quadruple season, you know, could turn into a bit of a damp squib. So there's a lot of pressure on the team. And Guardiola, I think even he showed that at the weekend. Mm. You know, he's pacing around. He's not quite his normal relaxed self. He knows there's an awful lot on the line. And Liverpool just keep winning and winning and winning, even when they're not playing well. To be fair, City did that on Saturday as well. So it's going to be fascinating. I wouldn't like to predict which way it's going to go. But what we can say is you look at the gap between the top two and the rest. Whoever wins this Premier League will have earned it.
That's the point I wanted to make. You know, Liverpool, if they beat Huddersfield on Saturday morning, which they should do, will go to 91 points. That's more than... I mean,
and they might not win it.
That's more than Arsenal's invincible season in 03-04 with two games left to play at a time in 03-04 when City weren't the City we know today and Spurs were a mid-table also round, basically, who weren't a big team. Mm. It's an incredible tally. And yes, whoever finishes second, it's the same for City if they finish second. It will mean nothing. You don't get anything for it. But it underlines how ridiculous the season has been from both of those clubs and how just far and away they are from the rest. And if they don't, like if City does have a draw in the next couple of games, there'll probably be some idiots coming out saying, oh, they choked when it mattered. Yeah. And if Liverpool don't win it, they'll say they choked. Do me a favour. Liverpool have lost one game all year. That was away to City.
This is becoming biased Liverpool.
Thanks, just, Scotty. I'm pleased you picked up on that.
It's just beaten by the better team, whichever way it goes. And two remarkable sides.
No, incredible stats. But if you're looking at the following fixtures, and I'm looking at the goal difference, the difference there, you know, 79 to 87 in favour of City there.
Yep.
So that is key. That is key. I'm telling you, it is. It
Is. But for that to come into effect, essentially, one of the teams has got to drop points. As it stands, City win all the games, they finish a point clear.
Yeah. They drop any points,
but if they drop any points, Liverpool are a point clear. So,
apart from all the stats, I just want to hear Martin Tyler do the thing he did a couple of years ago when they won it and Aguero in the last 2 minutes.
As long as he's shouting the same name.
If he can do that twice in his career on the last day of the season, such late stages of a game,
I'm not sure I can deal with that again.
It might be Salah this time around with the H's all the way around the back of someone's shirt. Liverpool got one of their trickier games out of the way against Cardiff. That was a tough one on paper because they're fighting for their lives. Now it opens up a little bit for them. City have the tougher run in, but they've also got the advantage. So the ball is still well and truly in their court. Cardiff's loss, I dare say Matty Ryan would have been sitting there punching the air and celebrating because that's a big boost for Brighton. It gives them a really good chance of avoiding relegation, and they've got Matty Ryan to thank for that. He was man of the match against Wolves. He maybe struggled a little bit coming back from the Asian Cup, but geez, he's finishing the season strongly again.
He's a terrific goalkeeper. And as I've said before on the podcast, he's also my favourite soccerer at the moment. I just think his dedication to his craft, it's very Schwarzer-esque. Mm. You know, even going back to his early days when he lived in the caravan because he didn't want distractions. And you see how he's, you know, rebuilt his body because he was a skinny kid with a shirt that was too big for him. The gloves were hanging off him, floppy fringe. And all of a sudden, he's a unit, isn't he? And he's not the tallest. We know that. Everybody thought that might be a potential weakness in the Premier League. But he's made sure that those flaws, if they are indeed flaws, have not affected him. And he's had a really good season. I wouldn't be surprised, you know, no disrespect to Brighton, but if a bigger Premier League club came in for him during the off-season. There was a bit of talk of Man United. That hasn't eventuated. But, you know, a club that's of the next level, you know, in the Premier League to Brighton, wouldn't be surprised at all.
Yeah, and you can only take that move if it is number one.
Yeah.
Playing in the Premier League, I mean, you speak of Mark Schwarzer there and this young man, Matt Ryan, is doing the same. And what a feat, because that is the hardest league. And you speak of his body, the way he's transformed that, and the ability to deal with these players. We look at our A-League players in comparison to physically in the Premier League. It will astound you the size of these guys.
Correct.
Their stature is massive, and the way he deals with that is great. And I've got a family friend who's a Brighton, big, big Brighton fan, so he's a happy man this morning.
Can I ask you a question? Sorry to interrupt, Garby. Can I ask you a question, Scott? You might not know the answer to this. I remember covering a youth tournament many years ago in Adelaide, and it was a Team South Australia. I think Inter Milan were there, team from another country, and Aston Villa were there as well. These were under-15s at the time. And Aston Villa won the tournament quite easily. And I remember watching the game between Aston Villa and Team South Australia. These kids were all exactly the same age. Gabriel Agbonlahor played for Aston Villa. That's how long ago it was. And I remember looking at the physical disparity between the young English kids and the young Aussie kids. these guys were men. Mm. You know, some of them had full beards and sideburns, and muscles upon muscles. And the team of South Australia, they look like 14-year-old kids, which is what they were. Why is that the case?
Well, I've seen the same thing. I mean, we had this this young boy join us, and his name was Moussa Dembele, the striker at Celtic and Lyon.
Yeah.
So he came up through the academy of Fulham, but he was a man already. He came into the first team training with us, and all the lads were looking at him going, who's this boy? Like, we were touting him as the next Drogba, but that's how big this kid was. It comes down to training volume. I mean, I look at the academy structures overseas. They are going to school at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning for 2 hours. Then they train. Then they have lunch together. They do another couple of hours of education and train again in the afternoon. So that is a professional academy. Mm. Here, it's not necessarily not professional, but it's not professional based upon time spent training. And it's not only just football, Simon. It's the high-performance support they get as well, the nutrition, the high-performance education and support they get. And that's why these bodies and the size of it is much, much bigger.
A question without notice. You were at Fulham when Adam Taggart was there, weren't you?
Yep.
You crossed over. He's flying in Korea right now at Suwon. I think he scored again on the weekend. How good can he be, do you think? Because he went to Fulham with a lot of momentum, had injury problems there. He's come back to Australia. It's been ups and downs since then. Hasn't got back into the Socceroos. You'd think he'd be in line for a recall when the upcoming squads are announced for June, considering the way he's playing in Korea. How good do you think he can be, considering you watched him in that environment in Europe?
The biggest thing people don't realise is they watch football on TV from here to Europe, and they can't quantify how quick it is. That's the difference. So they think players can, you know, correlate their technical ability and place themselves in Europe. I had lunch with Adrian Leigh last week as well, and we spoke about his transformation from Victory to under-21s at Fulham.
Yep.
And that's where Adam Taggart started. And they made their opinion on Adam very quickly based upon not his technique but speed and strikers and their ability to be durable is the first thing, play 60 games a season, ability to replicate the speed demands and the mobility that come with that as well and to recover. So it is very much a sports science-led sort of model over there in the sense that can they deal with the pressure and speed of the game? Because I'll tell you a funny story. I was once doing some work with a couple of players and I told my rec fem, that's how quick they were. No word of a lie. I was doing this one-on-one stuff with them. I had to accelerate and decelerate and then bang. That's just the speed in which they turn and how dynamic they are. And then when I returned to the A-League a few years ago, I saw the body type and I saw the speed and mobility and went, this is vastly different, vastly different.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. This might have been before your time. Did you ever come into contact during your days at Fulham with the guy with the best nickname in football ever, Papa Booba Diop, the wardrobe?
I'll tell you a story.
The wardrobe.
He lived around the corner from me, right? Yeah. So Papa Diop, Senegalese international, correct? Yeah, so he's probably about 7'4" and huge.
Big,
so we used to get home from away games and the, you know, Fast and Furious, the what is it? I can't remember the road. But anyway, the road going from Motspur Park back into London.
Yeah.
The A3,
that's it. So the one heading back into Fulham and Chelsea and Putney. And Booba Diop at the time was obviously Senegalese and had the whitest teeth and drove a white Bentley. So we would get off the bus and everyone would be in that car and it was like Fast and the Furious, all these ridiculous cars going down that A3 and all you'd see is Papa Booba Diop sitting in his white Bentley, white teeth at night, flying down there. He was one of the best and he hated work, so he'd always go missing, so you'd have to start the session and where's Booba? Where is he? And you'd have to go and find him. He'd be sleeping somewhere. Always sleeping. But, he's a top man.
Brilliant.
Well, we're still on the life of times of Scott Miller at Fulham. Is there a colder ground in world football than Fulham in the winter when the wind comes off the Thames?
The problem is the dugout, you're actually sitting in the water because they've cut out underneath. So I always used to wear trainers. The apprentice or the young amateur players that used to come and sit on the bench or staff, they'd be out there with their boots and I'd be like, bad decision.
Man, you Southern softies, you've never been to Oldham in January. That's the coldest place on earth. Never mind in England.
Guess what? If I had a choice, I wouldn't either.
Yeah, exactly. I was standing in the away section once at Craven Cottage. I was in shock at how cold it was.
Yeah, that wind
and it hits you in the away section, like in the face. I couldn't move. Anyway.
And I'm sure you would have got your Bovril at halftime.
Oh, man, I couldn't move to go get the Bovril. I just stood there. Please.
Were you there with us in England in 2016 when the Socceroos trained at Sunderland?
Yes, I was.
That was cold up there.
And that was in May.
Summer.
And we all stood there. I remember David Davutovic from the Herald Sun.
Murray Shaw and Eddie Harper were there as well.
He had a very thin jumper. And after half an hour, he said, I think I'm going to die.
That's a wind tunnel.
But it was like that Sunderland wind that comes in from like
right
underneath
off the North Sea.
And then swirls underneath your nose and then hits you in the face.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, just on how cold it was, my last job in Denmark, I thought I experienced some cold. And then the night I got home from my first night in Aalborg and my coat hung itself. So when I took it off, it was still standing on its end. I thought, I'm in cold conditions here. The Northern Lights are flying around my apartment because no one has blinds and my jacket's hanging itself.
Wow.
This is not for me.
What a great experience.
I'm out of here.
All right, well, that chat was all fun and enjoyable. Scotty, while I preface the next question, get on your phone, write an email or something like that, because I'm just going to strap my pads on to my legs, my arm guard, my helmet, my box, the shoulder guard, and ask Simon Hill about the VAR and the Manchester City Spurs Champions League game.
Yeah.
Because I'm a little bit fearful of the response.
I'm coming from the fast bowler's run-up. Look, I have no complaints about the final goal. I think it was offside. Again, I'm not a fan of VAR. I'm sorry. I know you said earlier on in the podcast that it was used correctly to dismiss Kai Rowles. I would agree with that. I'm not denying that it has its uses, but for me, I thought it was handball against Llorente. That simple as that. Mm-hmm. But I accept that I might be a little bit biased in that regard.
Yeah, but handball,
the fact
handball.
Is for me, exactly. But the fact is, the handball rule needs to be looked at. It needs to be
qualified.
Well, it's going to be, but not in the right way, I don't think.
Yeah.
All they're saying now is that if you score off your arm, actually, it would have ruled out the Llorente goal.
Yeah.
You know, even if it's unintentional, then it will be ruled out. But then they've still not brought into any sort of clarity the defensive handball. And on Saturday, the game between City and Spurs, there was a 15-minute debate amongst the commentary team about Kyle Walker's potential handball. And yet at the other end, 5 minutes prior, Vertonghen clearly handled the ball and there was no problem with that. Oh, he wasn't even looking at the ball, even though his arm was away from his body. You know, and again, I have no issue with that not being given as a penalty. But the fact is that I don't think anybody knows exactly what this rule is. And it's all open to interpretation.
Yeah.
And that's fine. That's no problem. Give the referee the responsibility. But once you bring VAR in, then you're opening up a whole different can of worms.
Well, the issue I've got is that I actually think we've got it right in Australia when it comes to VAR. We now only use it for clear and obvious errors. In fact, the Melbourne Adelaide...
What is that when it comes to handball?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's of course it's open to interpretation in a sense, but in a situation where you look at it and you go, I'm just not sure, don't overturn it. Like the Man United PSG one, people were arguing for days as to whether... So why use VAR to overturn it if everyone's split? If it's a blatant one and the referee's had his view obscured by someone, then you bring it in for handball. If it's one where it's half away from his body and you can't tell, just go with the decision at the time. And I guess it was the same with the Danny Rose one in the first leg, which City actually benefited from through VAR. I don't see why they used it for that. Because, you know, was it a clear and obvious error? I'm not sure. But, yeah, Pep Guardiola came out as interesting and said, you know, as much as he was hurt, he said, I'm for fair football.
Well,
the referees need help.
He's for it.
Yeah.
But, I don't think the referees do need help. And I've said this a million times. I think it's our game that needs help with its cultural approach towards officialdom. If we actually respected referees' decisions, you can disagree with them. Look, we do during calls in the A-League. You know, I don't agree with that. I think that's wrong. That's fine. But we've got to stop having this culture of abuse towards referees. This assumption that the referee is to blame for a result. You've still got another 8 to 9 minutes to turn things around. That's what has to change. At the moment, I think VAR is essentially giving in to mob rule. We're saying that the referees are under such pressure, we've got to give them some help. And I think it's actually confusing the issue. Classic case in point, Friday night, James Donaghy scores what looks like a perfectly legitimate goal to me, but Peter Green has already blown his whistle, so VAR can't get involved. People are going, why isn't VAR going to involve? Why is VAR? And why didn't Peter Green wait that extra split second and go, well, I can leave it and let the VAR make? How do you get inside the mind of a referee in that split second? They're having to consider like 8, 9, 10 different things. It's almost impossible for them. Mm. And we're making it more difficult for them by heaping this pressure on their shoulders every single week.
A little bit.
Do you agree with that, Scotty? As a you know, as a football coach? Because I know the coach mindset is, oh, our jobs rest upon these refereeing decisions. They don't really.
Do they not?
No.
No, I'm not. I'm not saying that because I disagree. I'm just taking everything on board that you've both said, and I think technology is we have it in every part of our life. It dictates everything. Now, as for VAR, I'm a purist. I just want the right decision, irrespective if it's going to save a coach's job or a performance. Just get it right, and that comes down to the person officiating it. What I don't like is you have this referee. That for me is his authority has been watered down because whenever it gets a bit messy, they handball it. And then you get the opportunity to look on video and you've got someone else watching it. And I just think...
But the reason they've done that, Scott, is because they're under such pressure from players and coaches.
It's a game of
human error.
I don't think that will ever change because the commercial value of the game and entertainment...
But that's what I'm saying. The authorities, to me, they need to take a stand and say... Players, if you challenge this decision, you will be booked or sent off, or you will be sanctioned in some way. To be fair, they're trying to do that a little bit. We've got yellow cards for coaches now as well, which I think is a good thing. Yeah. I think that's tempered it a little bit on the sidelines. But again, on Friday night, I was there. Marco Kurtz, Kevin Muscat, two of the more animated coaches in the league. And the fourth official, I'm trying to remember what his name was, can't remember, but he just basically ran the gauntlet for 90 minutes. He must have had his ears were bleeding at the end of the game.
Yeah. I'm not necessarily 100% pro VAR, but if it's going to be in, I just want it for clear and obvious errors, not these 50-50s re-refereeing the game. And in Australia, I think for the last 6 months, it's been used pretty well on the whole.
It has.
A couple of little errors.
It's adapted.
But it's adapted really well. And I hope they actually adapt in Europe and start saying,
the other thing we need, Garvey,
re-refereeing the game.
We need to hear how the decision is made. Mm. If you're going to use this thing, we did the experiment with Jared Gillett, didn't we, that's gone down a bomb overseas where we mic'd him up. I was calling that game. I couldn't hear him. But that's what we need. When there's the VAR is brought into play, I think as commentators, we should go, right, let's hear what they've got to say. And then they have the conversation and everybody knows what they're looking for, the things that they're considering and how they've arrived at their decision.
Under its current premise in Australia, I'm for it. If they start re-refereeing things, then I'm not as sure. Let's move along. We've got some really good questions. Should make mention, though, Juventus, 8 straight Serie A titles. Unbelievable. Cristiano Ronaldo says he's staying. They failed in the Champions League. They'll have another crack at it next year with Cristiano, but their record in Italy is just unbelievable.
And doesn't everybody say the Premier League's the most boring competition in the world?
Not anymore.
It's always the same teams that win it.
They might have back in the day, but not anymore. It's certainly leading the way in that regard. A question from Dane for you, Scott, which is a really good one. Of course, it differs between clubs, but what constitutes a successful season for an A-League head coach? Is there anything unique about our league which makes the coaching experience different to that in other countries?
That's a good question because I was looking at this morning based upon the win percentage ratios of every manager and every team this season alone. And what I do see is no definitive trend. No definitive trend when a manager survives the year based upon win, lose, or dross, draw, income, dross. Is that a bang?
You might have been right there.
Dross, that's not a bad one. Just get rid of a column.
A draw can be dross at times.
Dross, yes. So anyway, reset. Basically, what I'm saying is there's no definitive trend upon whether a manager lasts or stays within his role based upon the performance. I mean, you're looking at City, Newcastle, and Western Sydney, just for example, this year. I don't know their KPIs for the manager or the owner. All right. But ultimately, I know when I first arrived here as a manager, the expectations are you have to make the top six. I didn't make the top six. But was that realistic for Newcastle at that time? In my view, no. But we worked hard to try and maximise our time. You're coming out of administration and you're trying to make the six in the first year. It's going to be pretty challenging. But if it's a consistent build-up and you've had control of the transfer budget and the recruitment, I think that's when you should be... measured appropriately when you've had that cycle of transfers. That's my view anyway, because it is a very hard role when you're coaching someone else's team because it's a different setup altogether.
Yeah, right. Question from Conrad, which is on a similar theme. The Polski Wanderer is Conrad. Can you make 3 sporting arguments as to why Marcus Babbel should stay on as coach of the Wanderers next season? It's a good question.
Cultural, board decision, and trust. So they've identified him as a coach of significance. They've employed him.
Yeah.
They've given him John Paul as his assistant. They've provided the culture and the environment for him to succeed. Now, it hasn't in the first year. In terms of the points and the winnable games, it really does come down to what the board's decision is. Is it a long-term big picture, new stadium, evolve the team, academy structure? So we were talking about this before. What are his KPIs? Has he? I don't know. I mean, it's very difficult. I've seen managers come and go and lose more and draw more than others. And there's no consistent, but it comes down to the chairman's decision. Is this person right culturally for the football club? And does he represent the brand in a good way? And I think that's what it comes down to. But if the manager doesn't have that trust, he doesn't belong there in the first place.
I think he deserves the chance to stay on based on the second half of the season, and he deserves the chance to build his own squad. He probably benefits in a sense from the fact that Gombau didn't last long, so they don't want to make the same mistake twice, so let's give this guy more of a chance. But I think the second half of the year, there's been enough positive signs. They're going into a new stadium. You know, you don't want another off-season of upheaval going into that new arena. Stick with it and let him build his own squad, and hopefully they can start next season.
I think that's the key, isn't it, that during the last off-season, I think he only signed Baumjohan and Ziegler.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, neither's particularly worked. Baumjohan's worked in patches. When he's good, he's very, very good. Too often he's peripheral or injured. And Ziegler, of course, has barely been cited, even though, you know, he looked in the two or three games that he did play, he looked pretty good. So he'll be judged on next season. I mean, I do think he deserves to have questions asked of him because they've had a poor season. And, I mean, that performance, just to pick out their last game against the Mariners on Saturday, they were terrible. And again, the body language of some of the players wasn't, I don't think, particularly good. But I doubt that those players will be there next season. Yeah.
Question from William Doughty. How would this Perth Glory squad do in Asia if they keep all their players?
We're going to find out, aren't we? And Popper's got the experience of winning that competition. I actually think that Perth are probably the best placed of any of the A-League teams to really maximise on Asia because of their time zone and the fact that their travel, even though it'll be still a long flight, but it won't be as long as Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane or whatever. So I think they could do quite well. It'd be interesting to see, how much of a target they make that last year, given that Tony Sage has been very vocal in wanting to engage with Asia. I'm not quite sure on the terms that I agree with, but anyway.
Yeah, I mean, the squad has got quality. I think that might help them a bit, the fact that Popovich has experience and the club is like obsessed with Asia, so they're going to embrace it all. And we know some clubs resent it a little bit. They find it hard to juggle squads and so on and so forth. I think the fact that they'll be so all in on Asia might help the players elevate their performances and they can do well. One from Rex, what's going on with Lawrence Thomas? He should be in contention for the Socceroos, according to Rex, but he's on the bench of the Victory. It really has fallen pretty quickly for him. He was rated the best keeper in the A-League, arguably by many, not too long ago.
Okay, so when a player's dropped, I mean, everyone else on the outside can discuss why and have their opinions. Whether or not he's going to be a Socceroos goalkeeper or not, who knows? But the attitude of a player is key. When a player is dropped and he's not or he is available, it's got to boil down to attitude for me, because ultimately he's got the expertise to be a top goalkeeper, especially in this league. And when he is sitting on the bench and someone so significant for that team, and let's face it, last year that grand finals performance and numerous this year as well have been great. So for me, it has to come down to potential and attitude thing that him and Kevin aren't seeing eye to eye at the moment, and he's made a decision, and that's fine. And it will probably be a good thing for Lawrence to recognise that there is a person close to him and his position's not guaranteed.
I mean, officially he's been injured, hasn't he, for a few weeks. I don't know how injured he's been. Kevin, that was the reason that was put forward why he wasn't in the team, that he had an injury.
A few weeks ago, Kevin said, I've made a change.
He did for the Brisbane game.
Yeah, right.
But then he came back the week after, actually played very well. I forget who it was against. And then he was out for the next three or four matches, but that was officially due to an injury. Now, how injured he was, I don't know. I tend to suspect the same as Scott. I think there's a bit of an issue there behind the scenes.
Right.
Which has led to Muskie giving him a bit of a G-up, which, that's fair enough. I think this all probably started on the back of last year's grand final. There was a lot of talk of Lawrence going to Saudi Arabia. Lawrence of Arabia. he was going to go to play for Al Nassr, I think. And in the end, I think it was Jack Duncan who went there instead from Newcastle. They're obviously looking for an Aussie goalkeeper as one of the plus ones. Now, whether that sort of unsettled him a little bit, I think he's obviously at some point he wants to go overseas and test himself. And you know, maybe that's one of the reasons why they've had a bit of a fallout. I don't know the exact reason, but officially, the last 3 weeks, he's been injured. But he came back on the bench against Adelaide.
Interesting. An interesting point to finish on. We've gone a little bit over time today, but you know, hopefully when you're driving into work in the morning and you're a little bit depressed that the Easter holidays are over, this will give you a bit of a lift and you've got a bit more time in order to help that. Scott Miller, Simon Hill, thanks so much for your time on the podcast
Cheers,
today.
Cheers, Garby. Cheers, Scott.
A big final weekend of A-League action coming up. It all starts on Anzac Day, of course, and then we'll have the finals set for you. It finishes on Sunday night in the West as the Glory celebrate their brilliant season again and then start getting ready for the championship. We'll wait and see what happens with the Phoenix and whether they can win a home final or not. It's going to be very exciting. Thanks for listening today. Listen on Wednesday to the Ballcast with Murray, Harps and Speedy to continue your football fix. And we'll have all the action for you on Fox Sports.